right down to that
campaign. Sounds great. All right. Karen, are we on? Good afternoon. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Commerce and to order. We have two bills that we're going to be taking public testimony on. First bill that we're going to do for convenience for our records will be Senate Bill 118. We have a number of individuals that are here to testify. And what I'm going to do, the proponents of the bill is the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And so we'll start with their presentation first. So Joel and Corey, and I'm not sure if you have anyone else besides the two of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Go for it.
Senate Bill 118 prohibits the insurer from using certain information when consumer applies or renews a homeowner's insurance policy, adds requirements for disclosure of loss history report and notice to consumer, and prohibits the insurer from making adverse decisions solely on the basis of a licensed adult foster home.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Esslinger, if you want to start off, and or Joel, whichever.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is Joel Ario, the Administrator of the Insurance Division within our department. And Joel's going to do most of the testimony on this bill, but I just wanted to briefly tell you how we got here today. One of the things we do in the Insurance Division is we have a staff of consumer advocates, and their job is to respond to inquiries and to concerns and to complaints that consumers raise. And we obviously try to help individual consumers who call us, but we're also trying to do a little more, and that is to use the information that we gain through those questions and those concerns and complaints to see whether there are systemic issues or systemic problems that really should be brought to the legislature's attention. And that's what happened here. A couple of years ago, we started getting a very substantial increase in calls and concerns about homeowners insurance. So we have a healthy homeowners insurance market, so this caught our attention, and most of the questions and complaints arose from use of national claims databases and the impact on homeowners who found themselves facing potentially cancellation or inability to get insurance or a substantial increase in rates due to the way that these databases were used. We actually held a couple of public forums to learn more about that, and it was fairly striking, the level of emotion, particularly at the Portland forum. It was from 4 to 6 in the afternoon, and we had one of the Portland TV stations had been interested in it and ran something on the 5 o'clock evening news, so in the middle of the hearing. And we had people get up out of their chairs in their living room and come down to our hearing based on their concerns about this issue. So it was clear that we had a lot of homeowners very concerned. We did some more looking into the issues, and that has led to this bill, which Joel is going to go through in a little more detail.
All right. Thank you. Joel, if you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Joel Ario, the Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm going to spend most of my time getting into the detail here, what we propose in the bill in 10 specific areas, but let me just briefly amplify what Corey said about how we got where we are. There's basically a four-step process here. First, as Corey said, we saw an increase in consumer complaints. So we had a total of 257 consumer complaints back in 2000, and a couple years later that had jumped all the way to 418, which is a 60% increase just in a couple years. Now, it's leveled out in the last 2 years, but it's basically stayed at a much higher level than it was back in the year 2000, and so that caught our attention. Then we put our market analysts to work looking at trends in this marketplace and insurer practices and that sort of thing, and one of the things we found that's quite interesting is many of the things that people were complaining about were not done by most insurance companies. In other words, there were a lot of best practices out there in the industry that most companies were complying with, but some weren't, and then that was the source of some of the complaints. So the bill really comes from both of those angles. It comes partly from, here are some consumer complaints that people have that look to us to be legitimate and probably ought to be the basis for new laws. But secondly, they come from looking at the industry and saying, what do people in the industry do? What are the best practices out there? And put some of those into code so that all companies measure up to some of those basic practices. And I'll try to identify some of those specifics as we go. Third step in the process was what Corey mentioned with the public hearings. She said it quite well. I won't repeat that step, but that's just another step of outreach to see what is the level of public concern here. And then, finally, there were stakeholder meetings. And as we do with all of our issues at the department, we bring in all the different kind of stakeholders. So we brought in the insurance industry. We brought in the insurance producers. We brought in the consumer groups. We brought in the real estate industry. We brought in everybody who has a stake in this market and started to talk about some of the specifics here. And out of that process, we end up with this bill, which has 10 provisions in it. Let me say one other thing, though, before I go to the 10 provisions. Maybe I'll try to usurp a little bit of what the industry is going to say, and we can say with Ben covered, we'll stipulate to that, as they say in court, which is that overall, the homeowner insurance market is very strong in Oregon. We have some of the lowest rates in the country for homeowner insurance. I think you'll hear today that we're 49th in the country on the most recent data. We also have a competitive industry. We have more than 100 insurance.
When you say 49th, 40, can you just...
49th lowest rates.
Thank you.
I think we count the district in here, so it's Wisconsin and one other state, I think, that have lower rates than us. We also have more than 100 insurance companies, so it's pretty competitive. That's why we have the low rates. Where we'll part company with the industry, though, we'll stipulate all that, but what we'll part company on is that enhancing consumer protection is somehow going to be inconsistent with or destroy that marketplace. We just don't believe the kind of reasonable, targeted, surgical, if you will, interventions that we're proposing will have dire effects on that market. We believe consumers can be treated fairly, and we can continue to have a strong marketplace. So with that, let me turn to some of the 10 specifics and kind of walk you through the bill. And I'm going to be talking off this document headed conceptual overview. If people want to follow along, that will be easier than trying to follow from the bill. I guess they're... Okay. Do we have the fact sheet?
Yeah, the homeowner.
Maybe the fact sheet is not quite as much detail as conceptual overview, but it's the same 10 items.
All right. Let me just make sure before we get started. You made reference to a fact sheet, and then you've also talked about the homeowner's bill of rights. Do we have both of those documents submitted to the committee?
What you now have is the one marked homeowner bill of rights, as I understand it, and there's something else that's marked conceptual overview that I guess you don't have yet. Somebody, I understand, is getting copies of that.
Okay.
So you will have that shortly. Essentially, they're the same 10 items. The conceptual overview gives you a little more detail, and then you also have the testimony. So, but I think what I was suggesting is the conceptual overview may be easier to follow than the testimony in the bill. And the reason we're working off the conceptual overview instead of the bill is that we have continued to meet with stakeholders on this issue, and we have changed the bill in several respects from the bill that was filed, which we had to file months ago. And so there are amendments pending, and I understand you don't have those amendments yet, but you will have them, I believe, within the next week or two.
Well, just for the record, I know I have, and I think all of us have been distributed three amendments, a dash one, a dash two, and a dash three, which I believe are from the agency that have not been put into LC Farm yet, but they've been requested to be done. Is that correct, Council?
Okay, so you have our copies of the amendments.
And at some point, we are going to, or at least I'm going to be asking you to review so we can put it on the record as to exactly what might be in those amendments that we're waiting to officially come back from LC.
Be happy to do that. I have copies of what we submitted. With that preface, let me turn to the bill itself and start with the 10 items. And I'll move through these rather quickly, but feel free to stop me with questions as we go. The first issue is what is always number one on our list in terms of consumer rights, which is good consumer disclosure. Corey suggested that a lot of the issues that we have in the homeowner market today stem from the insurer use of computerized databases, national databases, flu is the most commonly cited of these databases, but there are others. And so the first issue in the bill is to make sure that consumers understand when these databases are being used by insurers and to the extent that they're affecting the rates that are being quoted or are causing denials of insurance, that they have an opportunity to look at those records and to correct mistakes in those records. And that is the first aspect of the bill. This issue is very similar to what the legislature visited in the Senate Bill 260 last session on credit insurance. The credit history databases are covered by a federal law, the Federal Credit Reporting Act. These databases on homeowner losses are also covered by that same federal act. And so most of the rights that we put into this bill to know about these databases and be able to correct mistakes and so forth and know if there's an adverse action, why it was taken, all of those things are requirements of federal law. It's important, though, to put them in Oregon law like we did with credit scoring last session, because we know the federal government's track record in terms of being able to handle individual consumer complaints, which is it's not a very good track record. And if we put these same requirements in Oregon law, then we're able to, with our consumer advocates handling calls and complaints, able to monitor and enforce those provisions much better than the federal government can. And there are some minor differences between what we have in Oregon, too, and the federal requirements. So that's item number one in the bill. Item number two, look-back period. We hear from consumers that complaints that happened quite a while ago are being counted against them. In auto insurance, we have a 3-year look-back period by statute. We're proposing in this bill, we originally proposed 3, but we talked back and forth with the parties, and now it's a 5-year proposal. We're trying to be reasonable here, and it's 5 years in this bill because that's the standard that's used in the CLUE database today. They keep 5 years worth of data. The second part of what we're proposing in this bill, though, is to also apply that, and this is very important, apply that to the insurer's own records. The insurance companies will tell you they can go with the 5 years on CLUE, but they like to look further in their own records. We think it ought to be 5 years across the board that you can look back into those databases. So that's issue number two in the bill. Issue number three in the bill, strict limits on midterm policy cancellations. Policy cancellations midterm are rare, but we did see a spike up in these kind of complaints a couple years ago. And what we propose here is to make the same standards that are currently applicable to auto insurance now applicable to homeowner insurance. And those standards will prohibit midterm cancellations except for very limited reasons, which are fraud, material misrepresentation, non-payment of the premium or violation of policy terms or conditions. Insurers would be able to continue to cancel or re-rate policies during the first 60 days after issuance. This is important because oftentimes in a real estate deal, the homeowner insurance comes up kind of at the last minute, and insurers are asked to bind coverage quickly, and so they generally will do that as long as they have the 60-day period. But a practice that we saw and that we want to put an end to is to then use new claims experience that happens during that 60 days against the consumer. In other words, that 60 days is there to review the records of what existed before the insurance was bound, not to have another 60 days to see how claims work out. And so the bill prohibits use of any claims filed during that 60-day period unless there's fraud or misrepresentation involved in the claim. That's the provisions on cancellation. The next section of the bill is on renewal of coverage, and there are two provisions here. One, we borrow from the auto insurance standard that the insurer should provide at least 30 days notice if they intend a non-renewal policy. And then we borrow from commercial liability policies the requirement that they should provide that same 30-day notice if they offer to renew policies on less favorable terms than the prior terms. And that's important because especially in a difficult market, and especially if somebody's being canceled or being non-renewed because they have a claims history, they might have a tough time finding an insurer. They need notice period to be able to obtain another insurance product. Fifth requirement in the bill is notice about the residual market. There is, because homeowner insurance is, for all intents and purposes, for people with mortgages, a mandatory coverage. The banks won't give you a mortgage if you don't don't have homeowner insurance. So there is a residual market. That's an insurance term for a kind of backup market where there isn't any private insurer that will take the risk. That's known as the Oregon Fair Plan, and the bill requires a notice to the consumer of the availability of the Fair Plan if they're denied coverage. Sixth on the list is no penalties for inquiries. This was one of the more significant areas of consumer complaints over the last few years. Consumers inquire into coverage. Say they've had a minor loss, maybe below the deductible, not sure whether to file a claim. They call the agent, just intending to get some information about what their policy may cover or not cover. And the next thing they know, maybe the insurer's calling back or sending out an adjuster, or maybe there's no interaction, but later on they find out that that inquiry call has triggered a report into this database and that the report is being counted against them. I've had one of the television reporters up in Portland visit me about every 6 months to ask, you know, have you cleared up that inquiry problem? Because if you can't guarantee me that people can call their agent and ask questions without being penalized, I'm feeling like I'm going to have to go on TV and tell everybody, don't talk to your agents about your insurance anymore. So we very specifically in this bill define what an inquiry is, and it includes any kind of question asked without filing of a claim. It's attempting to create a clear, bright line whether the consumer intends to file a claim or not. If they don't intend to file a claim, even if they're whether they're talking hypothetically or if they're talking about a loss, if they're just asking questions and not reporting it, it shouldn't count. Part of this is just basic fairness to the consumer. Most of the time, if you call up your agent and talk about whether you should file a claim or not, and the agent advises you not to, most of the time that's not going to end up in the insured database. Most agents won't turn those over to the company. And in fact, the companies in a lot of cases would tell you, you know, buy a high deductible, because not only will you save money with a high deductible, but you won't get claims counted against you on the record. So most people don't have this kind of claim counted against them. But some people do, and we got a lot of complaints about it, and so we try to draw a very bright line on inquiries cannot be counted against the consumer when it comes to their homeowner rates or their right to keep the policy without having it non-renewed. Okay, that's now we're through six items on the list. You're going to hear, I think, a lot of rhetoric from the insurance industry today about how there's general problems with this bill that won't necessarily target on specific parts of the bill. I want to emphasize to the committee that in our discussions, we believe most everything we've talked about so far is consensus with the industry. There are some quibbles, this renewal on less favorable terms. There's some real questions about that. I got a new question this morning about reinsurance and how that might affect renewals. So there are some quibbles, but on the whole and on the main, I don't think you're going to hear fundamental disagreement about the first six principles here. So that's important to us because I think we've got a foundation for a good bill just in those six items. Now the next four that I'm going to conclude with, I won't pretend that there's consensus yet. In fact, there's a lot of disagreement. The consumers would like us to go further in some of these areas than we have. The industry would like us to go less far, maybe in some of the cases drop the provisions entirely. And I'll explain to you why we propose them and what they are. Number seven is no penalties for no pay claims. If there's consensus that the inquiry should not be counted against the consumer, the next step is, well, why count a claim that is filed but then withdrawn at the request of the consumer, or a claim that is processed but then denied because there's no coverage, or a complaint that, for whatever other reason, doesn't result in any payment from the insurance company to the consumer? A lot of consumers call us and wonder why they're being penalized for claims that don't end up costing the insurer any money in terms of a payment to the consumer. We don't think those kind of claims should be counted. One of the things, though, that the insurers raised with us in that conjunction was, well, sometimes these things involve a more complicated story. So, for instance, somebody withdraws a claim not because they decided that they're going to pay it themselves or whatever, but because it was a fraudulent claim all along, and now when the insurer is actually asking too many questions, they better quick get out of there before they get caught for the fraud. So they can be a sign for fraud. Well, if the insurer knows that there's fraud in the case, they can take action on the fraud. This just says they can't take action for the mere act of withdrawal, but they can take action if the reason for the withdrawal was fraud. And we provide for that in the bill now. If you look at what insurer practices are, I'm getting more of the best practices here. Most insurers, at least what they tell us, their underwriting and rating guidelines are, and what we have seen when we go out in the field, we don't investigate everybody, but when we go out and do exams, is that most insurers do not penalize policyholders for claims below the deductible. In general, if you have a claim that isn't paid or doesn't reach the deductible, that isn't usually penalized by insurance companies. The variation happens on other kinds of no-pay claims. So there are many different kind of market practices above that. So it's an item that's on the list that still remains controversial. Number 8 on our list, no penalties for natural cause claims. We propose in the bill that it's anything that's a natural cause claim, which is defined as sort of severe weather or other natural disaster type claim, should not be used to penalize the consumer. When you say use windstorm as an example here, the wind damages your home and dozens of others in town. It really doesn't have much to do with your maintenance of the property. It probably doesn't have much to do with the likelihood of another storm. I mean, you can imagine situations on the Florida coast or something where you might have a different argument, but in general, the storms are hit with sort of a randomness to them, and so they ought not to be the source of a penalty to the consumer. And this bill would prohibit insurers from using that type of claim to cancel or non-renew policies or to increase rates. Again, the insurers bring up, well, sometimes when we're exploring weather claims, we find out that there's more to the story. The one that we probably discussed ad nauseum in our stakeholder groups is the roof blows off not just because of the storm, but because it wasn't properly maintained. There was a reason why this was the one roof on the block that blew off and the other 10 didn't. Well, if they go out and look at the claim and in the process of claims handling find poor maintenance on the property, that is an independent ground to take action, and nothing in the bill would prohibit them from taking action for that. But they can't, on the computer, say, gee, weather claim canceled or rated up. So that's the weather claim issue. And again, I think it's 75% of insurers do not take action on the first weather claim. So the general practice in the industry is, at least with regard to the first weather claim, not to take action against the consumer. Ninth issue on the list, no penalties for mitigated claims. This is probably the most difficult and most controversial issue that we've had in the work groups. But let me explain first of all what we're trying to do here. What consumers complain to us sometimes, and we heard a couple people eloquently on this topic in the public forum in Portland, is that they're being penalized for past claims even though the situation that caused the claim, the underlying risk, has been mitigated or eliminated. And an example would be a homeowner who filed a claim because a tree fell on the house. Now, and this is what they told us at the hearing. Now, the insurance company said, gee, you know, these trees, windy area, you know, this is a risk. Well, the person removes all the trees from their property, or all the trees that could fall on the structures on the property. Now, that property doesn't have any of that risk anymore, and consumers tell us, you know, why should we be penalized for those sorts of things? A second kind of example would be a consumer buys a new home, and the insurer says, well, you don't have any claim history, but the house you're buying, the prior owner had some claims. And the consumer says, well, you know, we've had an inspection and checked everything. All that was repaired and so forth. The last insurance company signed off, and to the extent it took more than just repair, the underlying cause has been mitigated and so forth. If that's true, we don't think those kind of claims should be counted against the consumer. The insurers say, well, it's tough here because, you know, just because there's been a claim and it's been addressed doesn't mean the underlying cause really has been mitigated or removed. Well, we put the burden on the consumer in this case to demonstrate that there has been mitigation. I would submit to you that the trees that fell on the house and now there are no trees on the property, that's a pretty clear case. Other cases may not be as clear, and that'll be part of the insurer's argument. But again, we put the burden in the bill, to be fair here, on the consumer to show that there's been mitigation, and where there's been mitigation, we don't think it should count against the consumer. Then finally, the last area in the bill, number 10, is non-discrimination against adult foster care homes. We wrestle with this issue in the broader context of a crisis in adult foster care, where adult foster care providers, which are a major backbone of our social service system here in Oregon, cannot get liability insurance for their adult foster care operations. Well, it's a separate story what we can do about that problem. We're working on that, but fortunately for this committee, we're not. You guys don't have to wrestle with that one today. But to add insult to injury, so to speak, some of those adult foster care folks are losing their homeowner insurance because the insurers say, well, if you got an adult foster care in the household, you know, who knows what's going to happen there, and that's a higher risk situation for us, and so we don't want to be near that property, so we won't provide homeowner insurance for that as well. This bill would prohibit that kind of activity. It would prohibit insurers from either rating people up or canceling them, non-renewing them based on adult foster care in the home. It would also prohibit them from requiring the person to have adult foster care. I mean, I wish we could require everybody to have adult foster care in this context, but we don't have the markets for it right now, so it would prohibit discriminating against them simply because they don't have the insurance. Now, the insurers here say, well, that doesn't work very well then, because we all know that, you know, if something happens in the house, the person's going to try to find a way to slide it under the homeowner policy. So the bill has a provision in it saying that that risk has to be separated out, and you know, essentially a wall built there. Now, you can argue about whether the wall was permanent, but that's what you hear from the insurers. But we think you can make that kind of system work. Those are the provisions of the bill. We would be happy, as you can see, there are still issues here that could, I think, still benefit from some discussion. We would be happy to either have the bill reported out as is or to be part of a work group on the bill, if that was the desire of the committee. With that, I'll close. And I've got a note here that says only the dash threes are the insurance divisions. So I'm not sure what you have as dash ones and twos, but apparently only the threes are ours.
Okay.
With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Before we take any questions from this panel, I'm going to ask you to step back. Senator Decker's here, and I know he has some other obligations. He has testimony that he and a constituent wants to give. I'll call you right back up, but I want to give him an opportunity to put that on the record so he can go on and do his.
Just in the context, I'd note that most of what's in that bill is in our bill, too. But
okay. Well, Senator Decker, why don't you come up with your constituent, if you have one, that wanted to give testimony. Are you here to give testimony on Senate Bill 118 or 459? I mean, 459, if you haven't seen it, pretty much built into 118. But I'll be glad to close this one, open up the other one, however you want it done.
No, Mr. Chair, Ryan Deckard, Senate District 14. I think our preference would be, we introduced Senate Bill 459. I did it on behalf of my constituent who's here with me, Ken Evanson. But I think our preference would be whatever the chair's preference, but much of the suggestions that you will hear in one moment are embodied in 118.
Yeah. We will be allowing people, if they want to testify on 459, to do so. At this point, Mr. Powell's the only one that signed up. He's also signed up for 118. It's my thought that these bills are going to collapse into one as we move forward through this process. So we'll leave the record open for 118, and why don't we go ahead and get started.
Well, and Mr. Chair, we will try to, I mean, it's my goal to limit our testimony to at least 30 minutes here before you rate.
Considering what we have today, that would probably be wise to do 30 minutes minus 27. How's
27.
That?
I'll do the math. Well, I'm gonna be brief then and just introduce Ken. Ken's worked in the insurance industry for 37 years in life insurance. The provision that he's going to talk to you about deals with consumer notification. It seems to me a very wise and needed addition that should it be, I hope, accepted both from the industry and from consumers. And with that, Mr. Evanson.
Is this one going here? Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you here for a couple of minutes anyway. I'm just a...
You identify yourself for the record, so we'll have that on the record. So.
You bet. I'm just a married family man, Ken Evanson. Kenneth M. Evanson, Jr., specifically.
All right, Mr. Evanson, thank you for identifying yourself.
Sure. Five kids, 37 years doing one thing with the Pruitts here in Oregon. Six generations I had as a grandchild. I am here today to suggest that we try to do something to prevent the financial harm from happening to others that happened to me. That was extremely difficult and devastating to my family. And it all deals with mandatory notification of policy benefit reductions. The story is pretty simple and can be stated in just a moment. But 17 days before my policy renewal date, State Farm said they sent me a notice that changed my policy. Well, I never saw a notice. My wife and I searched for that notice, never could find it, although they said they did it. And so we asked them to prove that they sent us this notice, because I had one of those unlimited replacement policies. They said, well, sorry, Mr. Evanson, we don't have to show you any proof because it's not required. And I said, well, do you have any proof? No, we just have a computer notification that they did that. So the long and the short of it is I had my policy change without being notified, no call from my agent. Nothing happened to let me have an opportunity to up my benefits because it had otherwise been reduced. They'd gone to a stated amount kind of a policy instead of unlimited cost replacement. As a result of that, I ended up being out of pocket close to $250,000. It changed my life. It put my retirement back 10 years, had to collapse all my IRAs, my college savings for the kids, borrow every credit line I could possibly borrow. If it's all here if you got one of these. It was just one of the worst experiences of my life, and while State Farm did pay the part that their now stated amount said they would do, they simply refused to budge on what the policy 18 days before that would have done. So my request is very simple. My request is that there be some sort of implementation of a mandatory notification and proof of notification system built in so that some company can't just say, okay, we sent you stuff, no, we don't have to prove it, too bad. And in the absence of being able to prove that, like certified mail return request, that kind of thing, that the old policy continues. They just can't do this willy-nilly to those who, like me, who had been 40 years with State Farm and just wasn't notified. Well, that's pretty much it. My wife has had to go to work. The kids have a lot less mom time. This has changed our lifestyle and not for the better. So I'm, again, want to just re-stress. I think it's so important that there be a mandatory notification system in place so that when the companies change the policy benefits to be less than what they were before, and I don't mean at the request of the policyholder, I'm talking about other than at the request of the policyholder, that there is a way that they can show for sure, for real, for proof, that they did in fact notify the policy owner. And that will prevent what happened to me from happening to others. And it's a pretty simple idea. I sure will answer any questions you have. I really thank you for the opportunity to be here and share this thought with me that happened in 1997 and we are still digging out of.
Mr. Evanson, thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Decker, did you have anything else that you'd wanted to include? And committee, any questions for Mr. Evanson? If not, thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. If we can have the representatives from DPCS back at the table. And committee members, any questions for the panel at this point? What I'm going to ask is, since I don't see any at this point, I do want to go over a couple of things. I understand that the Dash 3s are the only ones that are being submitted by DCBS and as the amendments. And what I heard in the testimony was that this was after continued negotiations after the bill had been submitted through the executive branch process, and that it actually has, based on my review and what I've heard in the testimony, has actually made changes or is suggesting changes to the bill that would be more favorable to the industry, such as removing the three-year look back and adding in a five-year look back. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct in that case. There are a number of them that tilt towards the industry side. There are a number of others that tilt towards the consumer side. So there's enough for both sides to not like about what we did.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get on the record, because I just heard that there's maybe going one way. I just want to make sure that this was even play, that based on additional feedback once it came in.
Anything else?
Actually, yes, sir.
Senator Wissett, go right ahead.
Mr. Ariel, on the item number four, and this is also what Mr. Evanson spoke to, if you're required to make a 30 or 45 day renewal intention notice, what happens if the you know, find a meth lab in the house 15 days before the renewal the renewal date of the contract?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, I believe that you would be able to take, I mean, I know you'd be able to take action against a new issue on the property. I would say a meth lab would clearly constitute a violation of the policy terms such that it would be would allow you to cancel the policy on short notice, even in the middle of a term, much less before the start of a term. So there are that's the purpose of the some of the language in there about midterm cancellation for things that are of that nature. You know, fundamental problems under the policy. I look for that language again. I can read it to you, which would be it's at top of page four in my testimony. It's fraud, material misrepresentation, non-payment, or violation of policy terms or conditions. Putting having a meth lab in your property would be a violation of policy terms or conditions sufficient to trigger a midterm cancellation.
And for the record, I find that on page 14 of the bill, section 5, starting on line 21 and going through line 26. Is that what you're referencing to? I know you're going to your testimony.
Yes, it would actually be subpoint C there on line 26. Violation of any of the terms or conditions of the policy.
Go right ahead.
To Mr. Ario, to follow up on that thought, let's take a different example then, something much less egregious than a meth lab. Let's say that we have a leaking roof or water damage in the house during that period, that the insurance company should be able to take into consideration, but they have already committed to something ahead of time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the general issue that you're asking about is what happens if the discovery is made just before the policy renews but after the notice has been sent. I'm going to have to get back to you. You've got a question that stumps me. I don't know the answer. I think the insurer would be able to take action, but I need to get back to you on the specific answer to that.
Thank you.
Senator, any other questions? Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got a number of people who are here to testify in support of the of Senate Bill 118. I also have one or two individuals that are here that have traveled over 100 miles that are in opposition of the bill. What I'm going to do, I'm going to ask Sam Sorich and Dan Boom, would you like to testify now since you've come 100 miles? Please come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the panel, I'm Sam Sorich. I'm Vice President of the Property Casualty Insurance Association of America. With me is Dan Boone, who is a claims representative from Allstate Insurance Company. Again, I am with the Property Casualty Insurers Association, the PCI. We're an association of insurance companies. More than 300 of our member companies are doing business in Oregon, and our members are responsible for about 30% of the homeowners' premiums written in the state. As you know, insurance is different than other products and services. When a homeowner's insurer sells a policy, the insurer does not know whether that policyholder is going to file a claim, and if a claim is filed, what the cost of that claim would be. So what we as insurance companies do is try to look at a number of factors that help us determine the likelihood that a claim will be filed. So insurance companies look at the condition of the home, the type of construction, the location of the home, the fire protection district, whether there's a hazard like a trampoline or a pool, and whether or not the policyholder or that property has been subject to a past claim. Because there's a solid body of statistical evidence that indicates that properties and policyholders who have filed past claims are more likely to file future claims. The reality is that people that file a number of past claims are more likely, statistically, generally, to file claims in the future. That's the reality. If we as insurance companies are forced to ignore that reality, policyholders and the great majority of policyholders who have no claims or relatively few claims are going to be forced to pay more than they should be paying for homeowners insurance to subsidize those few claimants who file a great number or above average number of claims. Today in Oregon, homeowners insurance companies are able to consider a number of factors, including whether or not there have been past claims. And that has inured to the benefit of homeowners of consumers in Oregon. As the director said, the latest figures on what the average premiums are around the country show that Oregon ranks 49th. Only Idaho and Wisconsin have lower average homeowners insurance premiums than Oregon. Homeowners insurance is readily available in the state. There's more than 100 companies writing homeowners insurance. The FAIR plan, which is where homeowners go if they cannot find insurance, writes only 0.3% of the total market. You heard from the director that in 2004, there were 375 complaints about homeowners insurance. The fact is, there are nearly a million homeowners policies written. The fact that there were 375 complaints, I believe, is not an indictment of the homeowners insurance system in this state. Our fundamental objection to the bill revolves around the bill's limitation on a homeowner's insurer's ability to consider past claims. And I think these issues are 7, 8, and 9 on the director's handout. And I'd just like to comment on a few of these restrictions. First, the restriction that would prevent a homeowner's insurer from considering claims that have been mitigated. In theory, this would eliminate all past claims, because in theory, if a person files an insurance claim and is compensated and fixes the damage, that claim, in a sense, has been mitigated. And I think this limitation would also lead to absurd results. There's no definition of what mitigation means. Does it mean that a person who's had a wild party and files a liability claim and then promises never to have a party again, has that person mitigated the claim? And this requirement would force insurance companies to go out to every property, investigate, and determine whether or not a claim has actually been mitigated. And that is simply impossible and would be extraordinarily expensive. Another condition that would be imposed is the elimination of so-called natural causes. The bill defines a natural occurrence as an unpredictable natural cause. Well, I think any weather-related claim is unpredictable. The fact is that 40% of homeowners' claims are related to weather. And it would create a situation where a homeowner whose fence continually falls down because of wind would be able to file claims without those past claims being considered when his current or new insurance company writes a policy. That turns the homeowner's policy into a maintenance policy, and that's not what homeowner's insurance is intended to do. The bill would also prevent an insurance company from considering claims that have been made which did not result in an insurance company making a payment. The fact is, insurance companies do not set their premiums to make up for past payments. What we do is to develop our premiums to reflect the likelihood of loss. And the likelihood of loss is based on the fact that a claim has been filed by a person and that there has been damage to the property. That's the fact that we need to know in order to develop homeowners insurance premiums that are fair. Finally, the last limitation on past claims that would be imposed is a limitation, and I think it's been changed now, to 5 years. This provision really turns the legislature into actuaries. We believe that if actuarial science can establish that there is a relationship between a loss that occurs 3, 5, or even 7 years ago, then insurance companies should be able to consider that that loss. The problem with the bill is that it starts from the mistaken assumption that every insurance company uses and considers claims in the same way. That's not the case. Insurance companies have a wide variety of underwriting practices. Some companies consider weather-related claims, some do not. Some companies consider claims that have been mitigated, some do not. What this bill would do would be to lock all insurance companies into one set of underwriting practices. We believe that that would eliminate choice in the marketplace and would also result in unfairness because, again, it would force the great majority of homeowners who do not have past claims or have relatively few claims to pay more to subsidize people who have filed a number of past claims. And our fundamental concern revolves around the claims provisions in the bill. We do have concerns about some of the other points raised by Director Ario in terms of the limitation on policy cancellations. We believe that the bill's limitation on fraud, misrepresentation, and nonpayment of policy provisions is inadequate because it fails to take into account situations when there's been a significant increase in risk because of a change on the property. We believe that that element should be available to an insurance company to consider and to take action to cancel a policy when the risk of loss has been substantially increased. In addition, the notice on residual market, we believe that that's an unwise provision because it would force an insurance company to immediately tell people when a policy has either been non-renewed or an application is not accepted that the person should consider going to the FAIR plan. Again, the fact is there's over 100 insurance companies writing homeowners insurance. We think that person should be told before he or she goes to the FAIR plan to look out in the marketplace because there is coverage available. And finally, on the issue of inquiries, I think what the director is proposing would put insurance companies in a terrible bind. The Division of Insurance's existing regulations force insurance companies to take action when they receive notice from a person that there has been damage to the property. An insurance company is required to undertake an immediate investigation, which this provision would say would be that even though an insurance company is told that there's damage to the property, that should be considered just an inquiry and not a claim. So we think that again puts an insurance company in a very difficult situation, would put an insurance company in a very difficult situation. Mr. Boone can provide some further discussion of particular types of claims that occur and how those claims do relate to the likelihood of future loss. But at that, I'd be very happy to answer any questions you may have.
I think what I want to do, since Mr. Boone's at the table, why don't we take his testimony, and we can do both, and we won't be breaking it up. Mr. Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. Again, my name is Dan Boone, and I'm a claim manager with Allstate Insurance Company in the local Tigard, Oregon claim office. I'm a resident of Lake Oswego, and I've been in the claim business for 23 years. I would like to speak to a couple of provisions in the bill that Mr. Sorich just mentioned regarding claims that are denied or withdrawn at the consumer request, or we did not issue payment. Some examples of risks or claiming behavior that we see, for example, while we couldn't, it wasn't denied for fraud, we had an insured who presented a claim for a 27-inch television and a plasma screen television, which was about $5,000. We asked the insured, as we do on any theft claim, to provide sufficient documentation to support their claim, and the insured decided to walk away from the claim and not pursue it. Now, did we prove fraud? No, we didn't prove fraud. The insured just decided to walk away from a claim for a significant amount of money. And other examples, we have an insured who decided to start cooking methamphetamine in his house to supplement his income. The home was raided by the police, and he was taken away to jail. While he was away, some of his friends decided to move into the home and left it in kind of a mess. Once the insured got out of jail and came back to the home, he filed a claim for vandalism. Well, there was no, it was just messy living. It was not vandalism. So we had a claim that was denied, no payment made, in which there was a significant risk factor involved. We also had, as far as addressing the issue of natural causes, I would like to mention again, we do get wind is probably the most common natural cause, and every time we do have some wind, we do get a number of claims for things that are just not wind damage, worn out roofs, we'll get trees that have fallen on a home. Maybe the wind did finally push it over, but it was about ready to fall over because it was an old rotted tree to begin with, and the insured should have recognized that it was a hazard and removed it. I mean, that's a claim that we paid, but again, it shows a certain lack of taking care of your home. We've had claims made for insured for smoke damage to an insured's home, where the they had wood stove, they burned a lot of candles, and it was just a buildup of smoke within the home over a period of time. That's not a sudden and accidental loss that's covered under the policy. We also had an insured recently who decided that they received some rather expensive diamond rings from a family member in Southern California, and on the way home they packed them in their suitcase, and the rings were stolen from the suitcase in, after it was checked in at the airline. We asked them for sufficient documentation on their claim, and they decided that their claim was really against the TSA, and they decided to withdraw the claim. Again, that's claiming behavior that, in my experience over the last 23 years, would indicate this is a person likely to have further theft claims. And are there any questions?
I'd say so much for Homeland Security, but I won't start there. I think we've got some other people on the panel who want to ask questions. I'll come back to myself.
Chair Brzezinski, Mr. Sorich, if my math is correct, I think you said the 375 complaints and more than 1 million policies. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I believe I'm estimating that there's about 1 million homeowners policies. Yes.
Assuming those are somewhat accurate, that would be one complaint in 2,500 policies, or about 0.04%. That's 0.000375. Do you have any sense of how many of those 375 complaints actually resulted in some sanction to the insurance company?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, I do not. I do not know whether those complaints were, in fact, justified at all.
Thank you.
All right. I guess, Mr. Boone, I'm going to start with your last example. It seems kind of, I guess, unfair from my perspective, from what I heard you say, that if a person thought that they had coverage under their homeowner's policy while they're traveling, and then they chose to, instead of going after their insurance for coverage, and thought that TSA in this case was actually the culprit and they should be held accountable, why would you think that those individuals or that individual is going to be a risk in the future for using that as some type of credit rating or rating for insurance claims?
Well, the reason I would say that is because most people don't pack their jewelry in luggage and check it in. They usually keep it on their person. And so for that reason, we found that, you know.
Do you know if Allstate, that's who you're with, if they actually tell policyholders that that's what they would anticipate, is that when you're traveling you're going to carry those type of valuables on your person as compared to checking them into a locked suitcase?
Mr. Chair, no, we do not. And I'd also, just to add, we didn't deny the claim. We just had merely asked them to support proof of their claim, and they chose not to pursue the claim.
Understand.
So,
okay. Thank you. Mr. Storage,
yes.
I understand that you're looking at your written testimony, that you're from Sacramento, and from what I heard, that you have 300 different insurance organizations that are in PCI, or is that 300 within the state?
Mr. Chairman, we 300 of our member companies do business in the state of Oregon. 69 of our member companies write homeowners insurance in the state.
I wonder if you could provide to us, I assume you probably don't have that information now, but looking at some of the ones that you had concerns with as to what has been pointed, such as the look back of 5 years, how many of the different states have any type of provisions that may limit, I mean, that look back? I mean, we, as has been testified by the proponents of the bill, and auto insurance is a limitation of 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering what we're going to be, I guess, grasping at is trying to find out what is necessary, if anything, to be done to the current process and procedure, and if anything should be, what would be fair and reasonable. And I think it would be something that maybe we should be looking at what other states do. Specifically, I would like to know on the West Coast, you've said Washington and Idaho have lower premiums than we have.
Mr. Chairman, I think it was Wisconsin and Idaho.
Oh, excuse me, I apologize. It's Wisconsin and Idaho.
Yes.
And then if you could also maybe take in the bordering states of Oregon, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly will. I would just observe, and we do not, our member companies do not tell us what they do in the marketplace, but I think it's just my observation that there are very few companies, I believe, that look beyond 5 years. But the point is it good public policy to prevent the consideration of past claims beyond five years? Isn't it better to have some competition in the marketplace? And if a person finds that a company is considering a claim that occurred 5 years ago, well, maybe that person should look for a company that only considers claims within the last 3 years. So I think our concern is this good public policy to mandate underwriting practices?
I understand that. And I guess what I would also ask you in that same context, if those companies actually provide to those policyholders or those looking for policies, what their criteria is and how far they go back. Understand, CLUE only goes back 5 years.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. I believe the other database, the A-plus database that is also used by insurers, does go back 7 years, I believe.
Okay. All righty. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for traveling up here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you. I look forward to working with the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the following individuals to come up at this point. I believe it's Linda Gatto and Linda, that one, let's see, Scherwitzel. When you come up, if you pronounce it for me, so I hope we won't continue to butcher it. Ms. Gatto, if you'd like to start.
Thank you. I will apologize. I'm going to have to read my testimony. I think I'll be more clear.
That's quite all right.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Pisanski and members of the committee. My name is Linda Gatto, and I work as a committee assistant here in the Capitol Building. I wish to state and request that the record clearly reflect that I come to you today on my own time, and I'm representing only myself and my husband as homeowners in rural Clackamas County. The intention of our testimony is to provide you with the narrative of our experience regarding the cancellation of our homeowners insurance policy in 2004. Our insurance was canceled because of a $370 investigational reimbursement related to a septic incident that occurred 6 days after we moved into our house, and because of a $5,441 fire claim that was filed by the previous owners of the home in July of 2001. 9 days before our closing, the insurance company informed us that there had been a fire claim but could not provide any details except for the amount of the claim and the date of the claim. The next day, our realtor contacted the seller's realtor requesting information on the claim, and the response was that it was a minor grease fire, that there was a lot of smoke. We contacted our home inspector, and he assured us that he had not seen any evidence of fire damage during his inspection. To date, we have not been provided with or been able to get any further details. This home is in a rural location and has a septic system. In our real estate agreement, we required that the sellers have the septic tank pumped and inspected. We received a copy of an invoice showing that the requirement had been met. 6 days after we moved into the home, while draining water in the kitchen sink, water began to percolate in the downstairs shower and commode. We immediately ceased using the plumbing system and called the plumber. The plumber was unable to clear the drain. We contacted a septic company who stated we needed a new septic tank. At this point, we contacted our insurance company, who we had had for 10 years, for their advice. Since it was a Saturday, we had to wait until Monday for a call back from the agent to discuss the matter. The agent returned the call and suggested pursuing a third opinion. A second septic company was contacted and fixed the problem by removing a blockage at the baffle. The insurance agent came to the house and stated he could not remedy the problem but could seek an investigational cost reimbursement for $370 to help us with the $620 it cost us to get the problem fixed. One day before the check came, we received a notice of cancellation by mail. The insurance company never contacted us, and the agent was surprised to learn that the policy had been canceled. The cancellation notice stated that due to the previous fire claim and a claim within the first 60 days, this was an unacceptable risk, and the homeowner policy would be canceled in 30 days. Trying to establish new insurance coverage for the home was very time-consuming and frustrating, as we were now considered a high risk. We were able to establish coverage, but there was a 30% surcharge on the premium because of the septic issue. The previous fire claim was not held against us. However, and this I learned from my agent, because the insurance industry is market-driven and sustained losses in the market, our current insurance company would not have written a policy on the home at all if our situation had happened 2 years earlier. After much consideration, in June of 2004, we sought legal advice on three issues: the cancellation of the policy, the failure of the septic, and the real estate disclosure requirements. The analysis concluded, quote, your case is one of those that contains unfortunate facts and laws, parentheses, or a lack of laws, which do not adequately provide you with a remedy. In conclusion, we did everything correctly in the purchase of this home. The issues that led to the cancellation of our policy were not caused by us. All we did was move into the home. We've been held accountable for a series of events and bad advice within the realm of what is legal and what is considered acceptable business practices. We would never have risked cancellation of our homeowner insurance over $370. Further, there was no damage to the home from the septic issue and no damage identified from the 2001 fire claim. We hope our testimony has provided you with insight as you consider Senate Bill 118.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony?
My name is Linda Schwartzler. I'm from Eugene. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have written testimony, too. On April 21st, 2003, 2.5 years after moving into our home in Eugene, we sustained water damage as a result of an existing hot tub leaking that was inside the house. We did receive partial payment for this problem from our Safeco insurance company. This claim was the first homeowner's claim we had ever filed in the 30 years we insured our home in Canby and the 2.5 years we'd lived in Eugene. We had always had the same insurance company, and they also covered our automobiles. I called our agent on July 23, 2003, because of a different problem, and I wanted some advice. I had called a plumber because we had water leaking from the shower floor downstairs, and it had seeped into the garage. The plumber said that there was a broken pipe 2 feet under the shower floor underground. I talked to our agent to ask her advice, and she told me that I could have someone look at this problem, and then if we decided to file a claim, we could. I thought this was a good idea because, after all, there wouldn't be a claim unless I wanted one. At the end of our conversation, she told me to let her know if we wanted to file a claim. I said I would. I had a contractor look at this problem, also the plumber and the Safeco adjuster. I was with the adjuster when he looked at the shower in the bathroom. Since the cost would be minimal to fix this, my husband and I decided that we would not file a claim with the insurance. The adjuster agreed and said to call if we wanted to pursue any further action. On November 10, 2003, we received a notice of non-renewal on our homeowner's policy. We were very surprised since we had only filed this one homeowner's claim with them in 32 years of the hot tub. On November 28, I filed a complaint with the State Insurance Division, prompting an investigation of my insurance company's practices. On December 18th, I received a copy of a letter that a Safeco underwriting manager wrote to the State Insurance Division. And I will just read a little bit of this letter. There is no doubt that the water damage loss occurred, and it was the insured's desire that an adjuster inspect the damage. The intent would have been to receive a payment had the damages exceeded the insured's deductible. Also, Safeco incurred manpower expense due to inspecting and estimating the loss. The actions of the insured went beyond what would have constituted making an inquiry about coverage. And because of that, Safeco's action was to inspect and estimate the amount of the lost damage. Then he goes on to say, we stand by the listing of this occurrence as a claim for water damage. We cannot speak to the insured statement about what her agent told her, which I always thought was very strange because what the agent didn't type into her computer during our phone call was at the very end of the phone call, she said, let me know if you want to file a claim. And I don't feel that I was taken seriously at all by that. I got a lot more information after talking to the insurance division at the state, and I was told that that the agents are required by their companies to report any phone call whatsoever. We had a good friend in Canby who was our agent for the 32 years we lived there, and he said that he gives advice over the phone. He doesn't put everything in the computer. And he says when people call with a water claim that he automatically tells them, we're not having this conversation. And that's the end of it. So, you know, too bad. Too bad for me. I called the insurance agent to get advice, and I thought this is why we had insurance. I wanted another opinion as to the problem, and I knew that they shied away from water damage claims, so I was not interested in generating a claim. I wanted information. Despite being blackballed in the insurance industry, we were able to get homeowners and auto insurance with another company. I just want to end with I'm very disappointed in the process of paying for something that I'm not receiving. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schwartzler. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I'm looking to see who is not here as a, let's say, a lobbyist or someone with a larger group. I see Mickey Tate. Mickey Tate? All right, and it has out to the side SPD?
Yes.
And that, what does that stand for?
Senior People with Disabilities.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and ask you to come on up. I will ask Grover Simmons to come up, and then Janet, is it Arnaz? Aarons? If you'll please come up. All right, and Ms. Tate, if you'll start off, please.
Yes, Chairman Pazinski. My name is Mickey Tate. I'm the Adult Foster Home Program Coordinator for Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. My purpose in being here today is to say that we are in favor of this bill. The adult foster home industry has been very seriously injured by the inability to obtain liability insurance, and that has reflected in their ability to receive homeowners insurance. A number of adult foster home providers, we have approximately 1,800 in the state, who provide care and services to people who are elderly or have physical disabilities, and that constitutes approximately 8,000 beds. We do, by rule, monitoring and licensing, reduce as much risk as we possibly can, but the insurance issue has been quite significant, and we have a number of letters from providers who have been canceled.
Okay. Thank you very much. And let's see, let's just walk, go through the panel there. So, Janet, if you'll identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you very much. My name is Janet Aarons. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy. We're a statewide nonprofit, an association of other children's service providers. We have 33 members throughout the state, representing about $150 million worth of services to about 78,000 children each year. Briefly, we are the Dash 2. I would be the Dash 2 amendments. Simply, what we're trying to do is add children to the non-discrimination clause that's currently targeted at adult foster care. We have between 5,500 and 6,500 children in foster care at any one time in this state, which is not necessarily good news. But what is good news is that we're going to be increasing that number of children in foster care because we're taking them out of the state hospital, we're taking them out of group homes, we're taking them out of other kinds of long-term residential care in order to achieve better outcomes and put them in less restrictive and more home-like settings. This is a marvelous adjustment that the state of Oregon is making. It's consistent with other national trends and outcomes that show that this is a very positive way in which to deliver services to children. The new mental health initiative that's in the process of being implemented right now will also be moving more children with mental health issues into various kinds of foster care. The purpose, I'm also the immediate past president of the National Organization of State Associations for Children, and I realized through some meetings in Washington, D.C. over the last year that we're starting to see a national trend with homeowner insurers beginning to deny or impact homeowners' policies as a result of learning that they may be a licensed home for children's foster care. And we would like to take this opportunity for a bit of a preemptive strike. I have talked with a number of my members who do provide foster care. I have talked also with the Oregon Foster Parent Association, and all of them agree that there is tension there and that there have been denials of coverage as a result of learning that they're licensed to provide foster care. So we would like to make a simple amendment to include children along with the foster care piece, the adult foster care piece. The Legislative Council drafted the Dash 2 amendment. We're a little bit concerned. We may need to do a little bit more work on that. Currently, it indicates that the foster home is under the direct supervision of a private child caring agency. 90% of all the foster care that's provided in the state of Oregon is actually supervised by the state itself. So we would like to make sure that it's broad to include any private citizen that agrees to be licensed as a foster home, and that it not be limited just to child protective services, but also for the various kinds of foster care that we deliver in homes, therapeutic foster care, proctor care, and we may be developing New kinds of in-home care as well. So with your permission, we'd like opportunity to visit with you a little bit more about doing a little more work on this for a work session in the future.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Simmons.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. As you know, adult foster homes are licensed by the state, and they're private homes that take up to five adult people and take care of them on a 24-hour basis. The residents live in the home, full-time care, and it's a major part of the social structure of the state. I had not intended to testify on this particular bill because I think the thrust of the problem is underwriting standards and much more complicated insurance issues. However, after hearing earlier testimony, I did want to put two items in the record which sets the frame of our concern. One is and you have copies of these that I just gave Anna. One is a cancellation notice, and it was for Mrs. Linda Keeney. And it's only a couple places to check. You are hereby notified in accordance with the terms and conditions of the above-mentioned policy in accordance with the law that the above-mentioned policy will expire effective at and from the hour and date mentioned and will not be renewed. And then the reasons for the non-renewal, Unitrends underwriting guidelines no longer allow for adult foster care business exposures and corresponding liability hazard. Probably a pretty standard cancellation notice. The other and last piece I'd like to put into the record is a letter from another one of our members, Mrs. Dixie Ellard, local in this area. And if I may, I'll just read it. It's short. She says, to whom it may concern, I'm stating here that both my homeowner adult foster care insurance policies, and she has two homes, and she gives the number, were canceled June 6th of 04. These, for two houses, were through Rainier Insurance Company, and they give a phone number, in Portland. It was procured through Farmers Insurance Company in Salem. They stated the cancellation was due to the company no longer insuring this type of business. Farmers also tried to find us another insurance through their other vendors, but after a month they could not find a company to insure adult foster care in Oregon. Also, we looked independently and to no avail, or else the premium was $5,000 and way up per house. At these prices, the insurance rates would put us effectively out of business. As it was with Rainier, we were paying approximately $2,500 per house, which I find quite exorbitant. 3 to 5 years previously, our premiums were $750 to $900 per year. We have had no insurance claims in the 12 years of operation as an adult foster care provider. So the one little part of this massive bill that affects us is simply to add adult foster homes as a place that may not be refused to reissue or renew a policy on a private home solely on the basis that the applicant is an adult foster home. So you're talking about just flat-out discrimination, a certain industry that we represent. And thank you very much, sir.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Thank you again. I've got four people that are still scheduled to testify. I'm going to go ahead and ask Mr. Dixon and Mr. Ledbetter to please come up. Is there anyone else who wants to be testifying in support of the bill that did not sign up? All right, thank you. Mr. Dixon, why don't you get started while Mr. Ledbetter's coming up?
Sure. Chair Przanski, members of committee, thank you very much for holding a hearing on this bill today. For the record, my name is Steve Dixon. I'm the consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocacy and research organization with about 28,000 members in the state of Oregon. I'm not going to belabor the points that Joel made. We are in agreement with the division that this bill is needed, and I don't think I can
sort of shed any new policy light on the issue. I would like to raise three points and then address maybe some points that the industry has made, if I may. One is the natural cause issue. I understand that there is some difficulty around coming to a definition of what a natural cause claim is. And I don't know if this example that I'm about to present to you might fall into that category. And if it's addressed by the bill, that's great. And if it's not, maybe it's something we would want to consider. Is I had heard from both the division as well as some realtors that I've worked with in the past that after the Biscuit fire, for example, there was a moratorium on writing business within a proximity of that. That was imposed by the industry. So that's just something for you all to consider as we continue to have these discussions. Another problem is that I think needs to be addressed. I've worked with insurance agents on the credit scoring issue in the past, in the last legislative session. I've also talked to some about this particular bill, and they've indicated to me that in their relationships with consumers, that they frequently advise their consumers not to ask questions about policies when they're low, when it could be a small claim, because they might take a hit and either be canceled or have their policies or their premiums increased. And thirdly, and I think this is a good segue, it's not specifically addressed in the bill, but I think it is sort of dealt with in the bill, is that unlike auto insurance, homeowners insurance is a product that looks at both the home and the consumer. So under the CLUE database, anyways, and I realize different businesses write in different ways, but at least I think under the CLUE database, and if I'm not correct, I can stand corrected right now, that both the home and the past claims on the home, as well as the claims on the consumer, are considered. Whereas in the auto market, for example, you don't look at the car you look at the value of the car, but you don't look at the car and the past damage if it's been in a wreck or a fender bender or that kind of stuff. You look at the value of the car, and there's basic information about the car. But the consumer is actually the one who's penalized if they're a bad driver. And one thing that was presented by the industry is that it's a statistical fact that property holders who file claims are more likely to do so in the future, and I would agree with that, and I wouldn't challenge that. However, the home doesn't file a claim, and yet the home is still counted in the CLUE database. The consumer files the claim. So that presents a sort of double jeopardy on the consumer when they're looking for insurance. The average premium in Oregon may be low, and insurance may be readily available, but that may not represent the whole picture. I don't have any facts to back this up, but I think some questions need to be asked about what happens when a consumer actually uses the insurance. How much do their rates go up? Is it justifiable? Are they more likely to be canceled? Those are other parts of the market. Sorry, this is just notes from when he was speaking. So,
if you want to organize yourself and submit something to the committee, that's fine with us. As compared,
I just have one more point to go through. On the point that was raised about mitigating damage to a home, the claim, and as I said before, the claim still follows the person. So why should it stay with the house? Mitigation does not eliminate all history, because the claim will still stay with the consumer when that consumer moves on. So that is just sort of the comments I'd like to raise for the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Ledbetter?
Thank you, Senator Prozanski, and members of the committee for allowing me this opportunity to speak to you about this bill, Senate Bill 118. My name is Greg Ledbetter. I'm here as the chair of an ad hoc committee from SEIU Union. And a lot of people wonder why SEIU is interested in the homeowners bill. And the fact is that we have a large number of members who have expressed interest and encouraged SEIU to support this homeowner's bill. Our process as a union in working on this bill started last summer, and some concepts that we were going to work with independently of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and in holding a few meetings just around the Salem area with our work sites and members, the response and the concerns from our membership about what was happening in the homeowners market at that time was pretty overwhelming. We had several hundred people sign up to volunteer to participate in actions concerning these issues. In my presentations, I came to calling it kind of a "can they do that" presentation. As you go through the issues in the bill and the proposals in the bill, if you look at each one of those, you reach a point where, as a consumer, you go, "Can they do that?" I had a water claim 5 years ago, and I fixed it. Can they hold that against me? I had a water claim they never paid for. Can they hold that against me? I bought a home and the previous owner had a claim. Can they hold that against me? And on and on and on. The issues that you see dealt with by the department are issues that concern our members, and that's why we're here supporting this bill. The department has some pretty good figures in terms of the complaints that they've had, although, as Sam pointed out, it's a minuscule number when you look at how many policies are out there. But I don't think it's possible for statistical data to sufficiently demonstrate the emotional and financial toll that insurance consumers felt when the hard market and personal lines insurance hit. People have a surprising loyalty to their insurance company, and when they have been told that their policy will be non-renewed because they had a couple of claims or that their premium has doubled for the same reason, their most common response is, "Can they do that?" They say, "How does a company even know that my company paid for damage when I go to a different company? How can they hold that against me when it was a different company? How does that other company find out about this stuff without my permission?" If I live on the coast and the wind blows some shingles off of my house, can they non-renew me for that claim? Well, yes, they can. Maybe the practice in the industry is to wait for two, but there's nothing that says they have to wait that long, and there are companies that will non-renew for one claim. And because of this, the consumer is at a tremendous disadvantage when they don't know what all these rules are ahead of time. Insurance is too complicated for most people. They don't read their policy until something's already happened, and it's too late by then to figure out where they're going with it. I think, therefore, it behooves us that the public policy is to help protect consumers who are at a tremendous disadvantage in dealing with these large insurance companies. I think that the proposals from the department are a giant step in the right direction in helping people out during the difficult times. The hard market that generated, hard market meaning a tightened market, fewer insurance companies, higher premiums, harder to find insurance, that's softening now, and the insurance companies are beginning to see increased profits. But I know they can't promise that there won't be a hard market in the future. And as these issues, again, I'm sure will happen, I think we need to have some laws on the state, on the books in our state, so that when consumers do say, "Can they do that?" our answer can be, "No, they can't." Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Chair?
Yes,
Mr. Dixon, you have some.
There was one other point that I think I forgot to mention that was raised by the industry, and that is around the look back issue. The industry wants to have an unlimited look back because they say there is actuarially it's sound, And while I would agree with the industry that the actuarial data that goes into, you know, insurance considerations is important and necessary, it's not sufficient for good public policy. And I can raise a perfect example, or many perfect examples. And one of those examples is you could take a particular class of people, be they low income or be they, you know, a race or a minority, for example, who may actuarially, it could be borne out that it would be prudent to charge them more based on the actuarial data. But it's not sound public policy, and I think we've all made that choice and would agree that that is not good public policy. So it's necessary, but it's not sufficient for good public policy.
Thank you. Senator Wissett, do you have questions?
Chair Prusansky, for either of those gentlemen, actually, you indicated that, you know, the liability posed should not go with the house, it should go with the owner. But I believe that sometimes water damage results in mold toxicity problems that can end up really causing the house to be condemned and destroyed. Also, smoke damage quite often that doesn't appear to be severe after it's been repaired will seep out and end up not only causing claims but also causing health problems in subsequent owners of the house. So I do believe that the liability can go with the house. And the question is, given that actuality, would you support the homeowner actually acquiring a home inspection at their cost to demonstrate to the insurance company that that the problem no longer existed, and then have the insurance company reinstate the insurance?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Witsit, I would have to look at that issue more. However, I do think that you can draw a parallel to the auto insurance market, in that you could purchase a car that has a series of problems. Bad brakes, for example, is one that immediately springs to mind, where, you know, that is not considered, and the insurance industry does not look that closely at the automobile. They look at the overall value. I'm not saying that the overall value of a home and where it's located and all these other considerations shouldn't be taken into account. What I'm saying is to actually lay the claim on the home is, and it puts them into double jeopardy that they don't really face in the insurance, in the auto insurance market. So, but I would have to look at your proposal, and without seeing it, I can't commit to it.
Could I respond, Mr. Chairman? The mold issue is a particularly difficult one for everyone in the construction and insurance industry, and it's an extreme case on the issue of mitigation that's very difficult. But not all water claims result in mold. Not all water claims that result in mold result in deadly mold, which are the big problems. And I hate to see us get away from the idea that, in some sense, mitigation of the damage shouldn't be held, or if the damage is mitigated, it shouldn't be held against us when we buy an insurance policy. If it's a more clear-cut case, lightning strikes the deck on the back porch, and you get it fixed. You know, it doesn't seem to me that that should be held against you, and it can be. Not every company does, but some would, and I think that's the most difficult part of this bill, from my perspective, is how to deal with the definition of mitigation and ensure that it's been done. You raise a very legitimate point, Senator.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. First, on the parallel with the auto industry, I guess I would disagree, because if you total an automobile, your insurance company won't reinsure that automobile for collision purposes. So they are rating an automobile. And also, if you live in Portland, you have a different automobile rating versus living in Harney County. So again, they are rating the automobile, the history of the automobile, whether or not the automobile has had a claim, i.e. a total, and where the automobile is actually physically located and going to be used. So they are rating the automobile. So and you seem to have a lot of information about insurance. You said you were an SEIU.
Yeah, I'm here as a representative from SEIU. I've been in the insurance business for 22 years. I've worked for the Department of Consumer and Business Services since 91, but I'm not here to represent the department at all.
But you work for
yes.
CBS?
Yes.
In the insurance division?
Yes.
All right, if there's no other questions, gentlemen.
I wonder if I could respond a little bit on this issue of the car thing.
I'm going to. We've got okay. time. I've got two more people that need to testify. I appreciate it. If you'd like to put something, Mr. Ledbetter, in writing, we'll be glad to do that. Or you may want to go by and see the senators that you'd like to discuss that matter further.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have Mr. Powell and Mr. Monroe that are scheduled to testify. I don't believe from my last inquiry, please come up, there are any other people who wanted to testify. If that's not the case, please let me know, because I'd like to be able to close this hearing on a timely basis, knowing that we all have other obligations.
We'll do our part, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Powell, I know you will, and Mr. Merle, thank you very much.
I understand the signals. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, today representing State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Northwest. Both who write a sizable number of homeowners policies in the state of Oregon. Mr. Chairman and members, we have worked with the department on this bill since the early days. I've attended both the hearings they had, the one in Portland, the one in Eugene. At my insistence, my clients have attended even an additional meeting at my request to create a technical committee. Mr. Paul Danner from Sacramento State Farm is here. Steve Merle, a claims attorney from Tigard, Oregon, is here. And they've attended those. And also, I've had John Shaw, who is Vice President of Personal Lines for Liberty Northwest, at those meetings as well. So we have been fully participating. I would not waste your time today even going through the bill, because we just have kind of what you have in terms of the general concepts. And as you can appreciate, the words are going to mean everything in this case, because this is a technical issue. And I don't know in a couple of these areas whether you can even wordsmith fine enough not to have a very awkward situation arise. But we are fully engaged. We're going to remain fully engaged. Thank you.
And just for the record, Mr. Powell and I have spoken. I know and he understands what the intention of the chair is going to be. And so I know that he's limiting his comments today based on knowing that there's going to be some additional work that will take place. Mr. Monroe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Monroe speaking today on behalf of the American Insurance Association, and I'll be even briefer than Mr. Powell. I, too, have been engaged at this juncture. As you can appreciate, it's, grabbing this bill is a little bit like grabbing a handful of tapioca, and it's in... in a constant state of flux, and while conceptual suggestions have been made, we haven't seen the words, and we'll need to see the words. I would make a couple of comments before I forget it. Senator Whitsitt has been sort of interested in the numbers, I think, and the complaint information that formed at least part of the basis for asserting that the bill is necessary. And in fact, you need to know, for example, if you look at the year 2003, that while there were 395 complaints, there's also a subcategory which is confirmed complaints, and a confirmed complaint is a situation where there was not necessarily a judgment made with regard to who was at fault, but some change was made. A claim was reopened, more was paid, whatever. And that number was, I think, 221, for example, for that year. So the number is smaller than might have been represented earlier. Again, we'll look forward to working with the committee and others as we move forward and try and make something out of this bill, if possible.
Any questions for Mr. Powell or Mr. Monroe at this time? If not, gentlemen, thank you very much. I have one other person that's requested to give, as they say, underlined, very brief testimony in support. Angela Kimball. Ms. Kimball, please come up.
Chair. Chair Prasansky and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Kimball. I am a policy analyst with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I just wanted to offer briefly that we are in support of this legislation. And while I'm not generally familiar with the insurance industry or pay much attention to it, I have to say that the plight of getting community housing and placements for persons, both adults and children, with serious mental illness is something that looms very large for us. In fact, just today, I was trying to help find a foster placement for a child in need of treatment foster care. At the very same time, we're hearing concerns from all of our mental health directors about denial of insurance for those who are trying to serve our community by creating homes and caring for people in the community. So while other members or other committees around this Capitol are struggling with the issues of a state hospital that is over census, a state correction system that is burgeoning with individuals with serious mental illness, we at the same time are struggling to actually try and treat people in the community. It is, in fact, the inability to gain insurance that is creating some of the barriers to actually solving some of our other state problems. So because of the parallel nature of these issues, we ask that you consider what this does to our ability to serve people close at home where we want to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from Ms. Campbell? Thank you. I want to thank everyone for coming in and being willing to give us their testimony today. What the chair would like to do is have the work group of the individuals who have been working together to take 2 weeks. I'd like to have some reports back by March 3rd as to where we're at. The chair does plan on trying to move something forward. I think this work group has put a lot of time and effort in this, and that we need to see if we can take care of the technical fixes and move forward with some product. So I appreciate your time, your willingness to continue to work on this. And again, thank all of you who have traveled some distance to come here and be with us and give us your perspectives. With that said, unless we have anything else to do, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the conference, the Senate Committee on Conference. Thank you.